We're taking up a further discussion of this issue we discussed in a different session recently about this concept of tafkid, that each person has a particular purpose or a particular mission that somehow or other is predetermined for that person. And I take issue with that idea. Now, it's being mentioned that there are speakers that try to influence people with this concept, and to bolster it, talking about stories from Jewish history, about even great rabbis, that their parents or others did not have too much confidence in them, and that they would have been satisfied had they been a shoemaker or something like that, but then they went on to become great rabbis. My reaction to that is I'm not sure what the point of all that is. There are many people from all different religions, from all different walks of life, who have the same stories. That they went into situations, and at the time they did so, they had no way of knowing that anybody would be interested or that they could be successful, and nevertheless they persevered, and finally it became successful. You'll find ministers or pastors that'll point to a church. And they'll tell you the origins and all the coincidences. And people told them not to do it, but they were motivated to do it. And then guess what happened? This thing came along. The other thing came along. To me, it's based upon a false premise. The false premise is that somehow or other, the outcome determines what the intent was to begin with. The fact that you're successful in a certain endeavor indicates that this was the hand of heaven. That's a falsification. We don't believe in that idea. That is a way of thinking that permeates all the other religions, which is a very dangerous phenomenon. It's based upon the concept of triumphalism. That if you do succeed at something, after the fact, this indicates that to begin with, it was divinely ordained. It was, so to speak, bashert. This idea is not just by Jews, this thing of bashert. That it was destined, it was predetermined. You don't know. The truth of the matter is you very rarely have any way of knowing if the outcome of something was because it was specifically God's will and God intervened to see to it that that would happen. Most people who become successful, and how you define success is very subjective, they want to believe that they're close to God. They want to believe that they're special, that they're unique, and therefore their success is something which is part of the scheme of things. They're not content to just look at it on an ordinary level, so therefore they have to build it up and make it a divine type of a phenomenon. This can lead to very dangerous circumstances. Let me give an illustration. It can have very practical consequences. I've just finished reading this book. The name of the author is June Levitt, L-E-A-V-I-T, or I-T-T, I'm not sure. And it's a journal. She lives in Israel, in Kiryat Arba. So she's been living in the, you know, this settlement, perhaps others, I don't remember all the details, for a number of years. This is a woman that comes from a completely secularized background. She was born and raised in America. And parents had nothing to do at all with religion, and she was totally assimilated and secularized. She doesn't really go into too much of the background, the reasons for how she wound up in Israel. Just hints at it. There's a few backflashes. And she met her husband, and he too was not religious, but they were kind of adventuresome. They wanted to build a life, a farming kind of life, whatever it is, some type of an idealism, and they wound up in Israel. Interestingly enough, they did become religious at one point. But I think at the time the book is written, she had gone back to being more secular, but very devoted to Israel, and they live in the most dangerous situation in the settlements. And the journal tells about the travails, essentially. Friends, relatives, people that are close to her, virtually on a day-to-day basis, because it takes place over the last 2 years when the Intifada was at its worst. And it does convey a tremendous sense of the anxiety that people in that situation have to live with. her own children, every one of them is in the army, and if they're not in the army, so then anytime there's something on the news, you're on the telephone, because her daughter was in Jerusalem that morning and had taken a bus. And so you're living under constant gloom and doom. And you go to Hebron, if she goes there on Friday or Shabbos, so you know that you're surrounded by danger. And you have to ask yourself at a certain point, I ask, would I want to live in a situation like that? And the answer is no. I couldn't live in a situation, in a settlement. I have nothing against living in settlements. I have nothing against that at all. But to put yourself in a situation, and your children, in a situation of virtually constant anxiety, constant danger, and the risk of imminent death. So, of course, the question is, why? What's the reason for that? And another question is it permitted to do so? In a sense, the most important thing about Israel is that it exists. That is to say, there was a great deal of controversy before the establishment of the state between the theological, the great rabbis, and the Zionists. There were some of the Gedolim, the great rabbis, who were in favor of having a state, of everything that had to be done, of this whole nationalistic movement. But by and large, the majority were opposed. And there's very good reasons for the opposition. However, in my opinion, it's important to try and understand the debate, what the reasons were, for the sake of knowledge and understanding. But from a practical standpoint, once Israel is created, once it exists, there's no practical basis for the debate anymore. That is to say that even if you were on the side that maintained that they should not have a Zionistic movement, that they would have been better off without establishing a state, that is not the basis of what your attitude should be towards the state today, because the state exists. And once it exists and becomes a haven for a significant amount of Jews, and perhaps the majority of Jews at a certain point in time, so then you owe your allegiance to it because of your allegiance to the Jewish people. Let me give you an analogy. Those who are opposed to the state because they maintain it was the wrong thing to do in the first place. Now I'm saying the fact that it was wrong, right or wrong, ab initio, beforehand, has nothing to do with the reality. Now it's a reality. I'll give you an example. It would be akin to the people having a baby. Let's say they didn't want to have the baby. And let's say they were involved in birth control, whatever the case may be. But very often, you know, children are born, even though people didn't want them. I think everybody recognizes in a case like that, the child is here, it's your child, and you have the full responsibilities. I believe if a parent would say that they're not, they can't do everything for this child, they can't accept full responsibility, they're not going to try as hard for this child as they would for another child, simply because they didn't really want the child. I think most people think that's a horrible thing. Because the most important thing about the child is that it exists. So once it exists, you can't ask the question, well, who brought it into existence? And to say that's true, we have obligations not only to our own children, but anybody in need. And many of the people that are in need came about because of the parents were irresponsible. They may not have been married, and they engage in careless, casual sex. But this is the product. So now you can't say that this child is not deserving of anybody's help because of the circumstances that brought it into being in the first place. That's the analogy that I'm using. The same would be true with regard to support for Israel. It's irrelevant whether it was the right thing to do or not the right thing to do. It exists. It's a Jewish community. It's not just a Jewish community. It's the major, probably the most significant Jewish community in the world today. And its welfare is of tremendous significance to the Jewish people. So therefore, one has every obligation to support it in every way possible, whether it be financially, politically, and if one's concern is about the fact that it's secularized and it's not Jewish, and then the people are not utilizing it for the correct purpose, which is the concern, so then to do whatever you could do, to go there, to add to the list of religious people, and to try and give Judaism a good name. amongst the secular Israelis. However, there's a very strong desire upon the part of people that believe. People believe very strongly. It's very interesting to note that about 25, 30 years ago, the majority of Orthodox Jews in America, I would say, were not that friendly to Israel. Israel has now become adopted by all of the so-called frum, Orthodox, institutions in America. Young Israel, I think Young Israel was always pro-Israel. But the right wing, Aguda, all of the fervently Orthodox yeshiva today in America, Israel, going to Israel to learn for a year, going on missions to Israel, and Israel's at the focus of virtually every American religious institution, especially the Orthodox, except for the extreme right wing that don't recognize Israel, like the Satmar and the Turei Karta. But other than that, everybody has joined the bandwagon, which was not the case 30 years ago or around that period of time. There's been a shift. I think a lot has to do with the phenomenon of the Six-Day War. The Six-Day War had a major impact on people, and especially the liberation of the old city of Jerusalem, which also meant the Kotel. The liberation, access to the Kotel, in my opinion, is one of the factors that had a very significant effect on people's attitude. People began to look at it differently, in the sense that people began to look at it as the hand of God. Religious people tend to judge things, developments in history, in terms of how they believe it fits into the divine scheme of things. And perhaps at first they didn't look at Israel that way. Israel was looked at as essentially a secular phenomenon, which indeed it was. It was the product of non-religious Jews, talking about the overwhelming majority of the Zionists. We're not motivated by anything having to do with Judaism. We're not motivated by anything having to do with Torah, with establishing the type of nation that the Jews are supposed to be. It had everything to do with ordinary secular concepts of nationalism, to create a new identity, a Jewish people, a nationalistic entity, in the same way as the French have France and Americans have America, that type of a phenomenon, which is not what the Torah is talking about. However, people have a tendency to reinterpret things in accordance with how they imagine the will of God is expressing itself. That could be a very dangerous phenomenon. There were many people who viewed the Six-Day War as miraculous. That can be a very dangerous thing. Believing in miracles can be a dangerous thing. The problem is you do not know. It's a very complicated thing. So you do not know. And you can't assume that you know. And then to make certain conclusions on the basis of how you feel about it. One of the conclusions that were drawn is that this is a sign, so to speak, of the Messianic era. Well, that idea that the creation of Israel is a messianic phenomenon and gives us an indication that we've now entered into the messianic era, that's something which is accepted by, I believe, most religious Zionists. It's incorporated into the prayer for the state of Israel, Reishis Semichas Geulasenu. It's the beginning of the sprouting of our redemption. So they're looking at it as something which has to do with the redemption. That's a very dangerous thing. Because as the Rambam explains to us, you have to know how to approach the idea of the Messianic era from the standpoint of Torah. The Torah does speak about it. The Torah does give us the general contours, the characteristics. That's very important for us to know. The things that are important to know, people don't want to focus on. And thus we've had through our history false messiahs, false messianic movements. The Rambam makes it very, very clear what these signs will be, the genuine signs. That is to say that they'll arise a king from the dynasty of David. He'll be an exceedingly great figure and will be on a par with the original King David. and he'll win the Jews back to the Torah. That is, the entire Jewish nation virtually will be won back to Torah. Not just to a generalized Judaism, but towards true Torah observance based upon the written and the oral law. So he'll mend the breaches in religious observance. And he'll fight the wars of the Jews. He'll liberate the Jews from their enemies and thus put them in a position of security. And then you'll have the ingathering, the final signs, the ingathering of the exiles, and the ultimate sign will be the building of the Beis HaMikdash in its place. If one accepts this as being the criteria, so one has, you're protected now. If anybody should arise and claim that he's the Mashiach, that he's the Messiah, all we need to do is to see whether any of the objectives have been accomplished, whether he fits the bill himself, whether he possesses that type of personal perfection and greatness which is envisioned. And even if he does, he then has to show that he's demonstrated that he's performed these messianic functions. The problem in history has been that certain people, because of an emotional desire to crown a particular individual as Mashiach, have divorced the phenomenon of the Mashiach, the person of the Mashiach, from the practical program which he must implement in order to be identified as the Mashiach. Put a different way, it is impossible for anyone, no matter what your vision of the Messianic era may be, to maintain that we are today in the Messianic era. It's clear that we're not. We're in the era of the exile. Thus, the Mashiach hasn't come. When he'll come, we don't know. Who he's going to be, nobody has any way of knowing. So whether a particular event has messianic significance is something that nobody really knows. The Rambam says how these events will unfold will become clear to us after the fact. That is to say, the Torah deliberately disguised it so that it would be impossible for anybody to discern its advent in prospect, but that it would only be clear in retrospect. Let us pause for a moment and ask ourselves why. Why did the Torah prevent us from knowing in advance the particularities of the advent of the Messiah? And what is wrong with that type of involvement, with that type of speculation? The main reason is that it can lead to falsehood, can lead us astray, to make us convinced that that which is not the Messiah is. And of course, when the truth will come out, as inevitably it must, that can lead to great despair amongst the Jews. That's one of the problems. Bear in mind, we also have a midrash, that when Yaakov Avinu, Jacob, our father Jacob, was on his deathbed, he gathered together his sons. And according to the rabbis, he wanted to reveal to them the end of time, to reveal the secret about when the Mashiach would come. But God prevented him from doing it. So the question arises, why did God prevent him? It would appear that that's something that's contrary to the divine will. Had he revealed it, it would have been accurate. It's one thing to say that we can't engage in speculation because we're going to make a mistake, which is going to lead to tremendous sorrow and disappointment. Now we're going further, and we're saying that it was contrary to God's will, that anyone should reveal, which would indicate that, let's, for argument's sake, that there was an individual who was a Navi, who was a prophet, and he had a prophecy, which clearly delineated the full contours of the Messianic advent, and could tell us, whatever the case may be, that it's going to be 10 years from now, and who the person will be, what the circumstances will be, or it will be 50 years, or 100 years, whatever it is. Should that person reveal it or not? I think that one would be prohibited from doing so on the basis of that midrash, that Yaakov wanted to and God stopped him, which means that such knowledge is contrary to the will of God. We need to understand why. The idea is that knowledge is absolutely contrary to the objective, to the purpose of the Jewish people, which is to reach a certain state of observance, of perfection, in which they serve God with a certain understanding, with a certain love, and they fulfill their purpose of drawing all the nations to the knowledge of God. That can't be achieved if the only reason why they're serving is because they want to bring about a certain result that destroys the whole value of the service. The service has to be based upon a person's ability to realize the truth. But once you have these ulterior motives creeping into the picture, it makes it virtually impossible. In a sense, that would mean that if the Jews would know when Mashiach was coming, it would be impossible for them to act in a manner to bring about the Mashiach. Because that very knowledge precludes that which is vital, that which is essential for the perfection that is desired. That is to say, the utilization of free will on the basis of the fact that this is the truth and this is the good and we want to serve God for the real reason. For its own sake, not because of an ulterior motive. Getting back now to the idea of the book I was mentioning about the settlements. It struck me as a problem that why would people subject themselves to that type of a life, to all of the sufferings, the anxiety, the losses, for the sake of living in these very dangerous places. Now, I'm not talking about living in Israel in general. Living in Israel in general has become more dangerous due to the Intifada, but certainly there are different places you can go. There are places where, relatively speaking, it's much safer. There are places where it's much more dangerous. So why, what is the reason that people would insist upon placing themselves, a small little group of people, in a forest, virtually, of hostile people? You're surrounded by these hostile Arabs, so clearly the chances of getting attacked or killed is much greater. We're just raising the question that there is an irony, in the sense that, statistically speaking, it seems that as many people die as a result of traffic accidents as they do from terrorism at the present moment. I'm not sure about the exact statistic, but it's roughly the same. This is very strange. People may say that in order to put it in a certain perspective. I think when people say that, they're trying to calm you down, put it in a certain perspective, to try and indicate that it's not the great disaster that people imagine it to be. But let's ask ourselves the question, what is the significance of that statistic? If that's the case, why aren't people as concerned about traffic? Why don't they have vigils and tehillim and prayer meetings about the phenomenon of death in traffic? For some reason, it doesn't seem to register on people's emotions. Let's assume that twice as many people died as a result of traffic accidents as terrorism. It would not have the same impact. People would still be focused completely on terrorism as though the deaths as a result of terrorism are worse. But why? Dead is dead. There are certain facts that people may accept on a rational basis which don't affect them emotionally. As, for example, many people are afraid to fly. You point out to them that flying is the safest way to travel. And statistically speaking, your chances of getting hurt or killed in an automobile are much greater than in an airplane. Yet for some people that doesn't register, and their emotions, their anxiety level is different when it comes to flying. What is the reason for this phenomenon? With regard to the issue of driving, even though a person knows that it's dangerous, it's not enough to merely say that you can drive so you feel control. That's a false feeling, because what about the other people that are driving? Thousands and thousands and thousands. Many of them don't drive properly. Many of whom are on drugs or drunk or drink, and they go out and drive in a crazy way, which causes accidents. Somehow or other, that does not seem to bother people as much as the possibility of an airplane crash. But logically, you should feel more secure, because you're dealing, everything is being done by professionals. The pilot is highly trained, and this plane has been proven to be functional, and it's tested. Of course, we know from time to time that the people are lax. That's the human factor. Accidents have to happen because there's a human factor, and there's an inability to perfect matter, for sure. But by and large, from a statistical point of view, the chances of a person dying in an airplane crash are probably about the same as winning the lottery. It shows you that a person's emotional perceptions can be more powerful than their logic. From an emotional standpoint, a person doesn't feel that safety because you feel that you're flying in the air. And something can go wrong, and if it does go wrong, there's no way that you can escape. When you're in a car, the feeling is different. The feeling is, I can control the car, I could stop it, I could turn out of the way, and even if there is a crash, it doesn't have to be fatal. So from the impact that all of this makes on the on one's feelings, it's something which is different. It's interesting in many areas, talking to people that go camping. The average individual hears about camping in the woods or camping alone, it evokes a certain fear. And you speak to campers and they say that they feel much safer in the woods because by and large, the animals don't bother you. You take the basic precautions, stay away from the areas you're not supposed to and do what you're supposed to do in terms of keeping the food away, and you're very safe. Because the greatest possibility, the greatest danger or threat that could be posed to you is not there, other human beings. Whereas if you're living in a city, suburban area, where there's high crime and burglaries and so forth, so there the danger is greater. You'd have to say that. Virtually everybody in the city today has an alarm system. Every car has an alarm system. But the feeling of being safe in my own house, that's a very powerful feeling. As opposed to being out there in the woods, the feeling is different. Because you have primal fears, fears of animals. An animal's going to just break in, whatever. So you're not functioning rationally. The same is true with regard to Israelis and the situation of terrorism. The phenomenon of terrorism doesn't register purely by the numbers. Even if traffic accidents were twice as many, the toll, deaths, or three times as many, it wouldn't matter. That is something that the person can absorb. It's something we have to work on, clearly, but it doesn't become a national calamity. It falls into a different category. It's human recklessness and so on. And again, the sense that if I drive carefully, then it won't happen to me. That's something that comes with the territory of normal, so to speak, life. It would be like saying, well, more people die from cancer in Israel, or from smoking, or whatever you want to say, than terrorism. It doesn't matter. People, that fact, that phenomenon, doesn't create a panic in people. They can deal with that. But the phenomenon that every time you walk out or take a bus, or you're in a cafe, and there's somebody out there that's going to blow you up, that's different. That's something which is abnormal, which people can't accept. It's more than just the idea of the numbers. People can't accept that because that's a very breach in the fundamental conditions of societal existence. There's got to be a certain public order. This means there's no public order. You can't, gunmen can come in and randomly shoot and kill people. That's the phenomenon. That creates a totally different type of anxiety, and it's something which is unacceptable. If this were to become a permanent fixture, it would be very, very bad for the country, for the morale. There is a big difference psychologically. Getting back then to the issue of living in these settlements, which I maintain that the psyche is different. The sense of insecurity has to be much greater for somebody living in a dangerously situated settlement as opposed to somebody living in the heartland, where it's true, then it becomes more of a statistic, where a person will go to extremes to avoid it, but it's not something that's on your mind all the time. If you're living in Tel Aviv somewhere, or you're living in Netanya, if you determine to avoid certain places, it's true, it makes an imposition to your life, but it's different. The question is, what is the ideal, though? Why are they doing this? Why is it so necessary to have these settlements? And to the extent that it arouses greater hatred and greater anger from the Arabs? What's the point? Why? Now, I know people will say that the Arabs hate us anyways, and it's not the settlements, and before there were settlements, they wanted to destroy us. I agree with all that. That is true. But why do you want to make it worse? Why cause more hostility? Well, part of the answer that settlers will give you is because we believe that this is our land, and God gave it to us, and we have to own it. We have to manifest ownership of every inch of the land. I want to mention that many people are motivated by a messianic idea over here, which is what we started out with. That there is a school of thought, I believe it's traceable to Rav Kook, to the effect that the Six-Day War is a sign from God that the time has come for us to take the entire land, and this is will bring about the Messianic era, and it's a mitzvah to settle every inch of territory, that God wants us to take back the land, that God wants us to be in charge of the land, every inch of the land, and that was the motivating ideal for many of these settlements. Therefore, if that's the case, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what the particularities are, what the practicalities are, whether it's dangerous or not. This is the overarching desire of God that we should do this. And therefore, we have to do it. To the extent that people say that simply we have to conquer the land because it's our land and God wants us to live there, that seems to go contrary to the question that was raised before. What is the purpose of Israel? What is the purpose of having a state? Why is it necessary for the Jews to have their own state? It's a very difficult question to raise these days because it's the kind of thing that nobody can question. That is to say, because most Jews are Zionistic. Love of Israel, love of our state. In my opinion, it's purely a nationalistic phenomenon for most Jews. In the same way that Americans support America, or during the Iraqi war, it's America, it's my country, I support it. It's a nationalistic phenomenon. For the overwhelming majority of Jews today who support Israel, that's what it is. It's a visceral thing, you can't question it, that's my country. And it's a nationalistic phenomenon, which really doesn't have anything to do with Torah, in my opinion. They've created something new, Jewish nationalism. Jewish nationalism, unless it's based upon the true ideas of Torah, is a age zara, in my opinion. It's a strange fire, so to speak. I was just thinking recently that Yom HaAtzmaut, Independence Day, and the thought just crossed my mind. And as I'm someone who supports Israel. I've just made that very clear. But I support Israel for a different reason. That what is the celebration of Yom HaAtzmaut? Well, what are you celebrating? Independence. Well, where do we find that that's an ideal in the Torah? Where is that ideal, the ideal of independence? That's a nationalistic phenomenon. That's a nationalistic ideal. That each people has the right to be free, to be separate, to be able to set up its own culture and its own society. But what is the Torah ideal of independence? The Torah ideal is that we should be a holy nation. Now, you may say that in order for us to set up such a society, the prerequisite is that we have the freedom to do so. Can't argue with that. But freedom over here has become the end in itself. We do have the concept of freedom in the Seder. On Pesach. True. But what are we celebrating there? Not the physical freedom, the geula, the redemption of the soul. The freedom per se is not the objective. It seems to me that when most people relate to Yom HaAtzmaut, it's freedom per se, in the same sense that Americans today, or people in the West, speak about yearning to be free. That is, that simply to be free from any external restraint, but freedom per se, not in the sense of some positive ideal. That's a secular idea of political freedom, which is not the Torah idea. When people get excited and celebrate Yom HaAtzmaut, it is no different, in my opinion, than Americans celebrating July 4th, Independence Day. Same thing, it's Independence Day. But that's not the Torah value, that's not the Torah concept. The idea that was propounded, that this is a messianic phenomenon, that this is the time and this is the sign, the Six-Day War, and we should conquer every inch of land, on a messianic basis, in my opinion, is completely false, has no foundation in Judaism whatsoever, simply because we cannot anticipate the Kates, the end. We cannot engage in messianic speculations. We don't know. We do not know whether this is a harbinger of the Mashiach or whether it's not. And everything that we do cannot be based upon the fact, well, maybe if we do this, Mashiach will come. That's an absurd way of thinking. The only thing we could do is to improve ourselves as Jews and keep the Torah and do that which is correct. And the closer we get to God, the closer we come to the messianic redemption. But not because we're searching for a redemption, because we want to get closer to God. The idea, even without messianic background, simply that this is our land and we should take it. That I find troublesome, because before the answer was that the Jews need a state. What's the reason for the state? Is because of persecution. The Jews need a place where they can be safe. Well, if that's the case, and assuming that Israel is the place, so then what's the point of expanding it? When the very expansion itself could be perceived as an obstacle to peace, or could be the factor which creates more difficulties for you. If you're sticking to the agenda that Israel has significance essentially because of the physical protection of the Jew, so what? How does that become a reason for just settling now in the most dangerous places? Bear in mind that I believe all this, that no one else has a right to the land in metaphysical terms. Of course I believe that God gave it to the Jews. Of course I believe that any other political entity, non-Jewish entity, would be illegitimate. The question, however, is the limits of our capability, what we ought to do, what makes sense for us to do in the present context. Does it make sense for us to engage in long, protracted, endless battles with the Arabs merely for this principle? Do you have a right to say that people should be constantly fighting and dying because of this idea that it's our land and we have to take it, and that's it? There's nothing, no other discussion. Or is this something which has to be resolved in accordance with Torah principles? And the argument that is made that people in the settlements, in certain settlements, can live their religious life on a higher plane than otherwise, to me is very problematical, because what was the whole value of Israel before you had the settlements? The argument that Israel is a place, that's the second reason, justification, so to speak, of the need to have an Israel today, because ostensibly it's the only place where Jews can achieve the highest degree of Torah fulfillment. If that's the case, so then it should be able to be achieved in the Israel that existed before the Six-Day War. Now the argument is that we can't achieve it in this Israel. We have to expand and go to a different place. That doesn't make any sense. So that shows that the original idea was wrong. If Israel is the place where people can achieve the highest degree of religious observance, then that's what we should be focusing on, and that should be possible within the pre-Six-Day War Israel. The question, of course, arises, what is the point of this endless fighting with the Arabs? Israeli nationalists, they're nationalists. A nationalist is, that's it for him, this is the ultimate, and he's prepared to fight to the death. He'll never give in. He'll fight 100 years, believing that eventually we'll achieve peace, we'll crush the Arabs, or whatever the case may be. But to a person from a Torah perspective, you have to look at it from a different angle. And the question is, what is the benefit? What is the purpose of all of this? Where are we headed? Indeed, in my opinion, we don't know. To be able to ascertain the significance of what took place in 47, the establishment of Medinas Israel, what its significance is, what its purpose is, what its benefit is, at this point in time, it's just too soon. We don't know. We do not know. It seems, as I mentioned before, the majority of the religious leaders of the Jews were opposed, did not think that this was the right thing for the Jewish people. The ones who deserve, if you want to say credit, for the establishment, this is something which was not established on the basis of the religious element of the Jews. Now, of course, all the religious want to take part in it. Fine, but if it was up to the religious, there wouldn't have been a state of Israel. Let's put it that way. This is not to criticize. Who was right? Who was wrong? In terms of that, we don't know. What will it turn out to be? Will it in the end have turned out to be the beginning of the heralding of the Messianic era? Nobody knows. Maybe yes. Can't rule that out. But you can't rule it in such a manner that you're acting as though you know for sure that this is it, and you're going to take practical, concrete steps and settle places and endanger people because of your conviction that this is it, and you have a roadmap to Mashiach. In my opinion, you can't say that. We don't know. It all depends upon how we utilize our free will and how we relate to it and how we react to it. We can make it, perhaps. Then I would say, do we have the power? With the help of God, do we have the power to make it into the beginning of the sprouting of the redemption? Yes. Someone suggested that instead of saying Reishit Tzmichat Gulaseinu, that we should say Shetehei, that it's a tefillah, that it should be. That depends upon merit. That depends upon how we utilize it. That is to say, that whether we are in control of every piece of territory, whether we are in control of the lands that were captured after the Six-Day War, is not the most important issue in the world. It's what we do with the lands that we have under our control right now. It's the kind of society we establish. It's the life that we live. If we make it into a truly Jewish state, then you could look back and say it was a great thing. But ab initio, from the outset, you cannot say that it's a great thing per se because you have no idea what it's going to be used for. There are very, very powerful secularist, anti-Judaic, anti-Torah forces at work in the culture of Israel. There's no question about that. Who would love nothing more than to remove any trace of Jewishness and Judaism from the state? And that's a battle. That's pointing out one of the negatives. But you can't just assume that everything is wonderful and it's all positive. That's if you want to close your mind. And say, look, for me, it does it for me. I go there, I go to the Kotel, I get a religious charge. If that's your attitude, fine, but that's not a fair, it's not a balance, it's not a correct attitude towards the situation as a whole. I go back to what I said a number of years ago, that the singing of HaTikvah, which is a very nice song, I only object to one word, which I advise everyone to change, because this was not revealed at Sinai, the wording of the national anthem. And this is a text which is very much subject to, requires, and it would be very legitimate to make a change. It says, Liot Am Chafshi, HaTikva. This is our hope of 2,000 years. Liot Am Chafshi, to be a free people, Biartzenu, in our land. Again, I would say that the idea of Chafshi, to be free, is not a Torah ideal. There's no such concept. When they say Chafshi, they mean, in the same sense, as Western, secular, hedonistic, to be totally free to do whatever you want to do. And that's the good, that is the best state to be in. That is the value of secular contemporary America. Now, that type of freedom is very good for us in America because it enables the Jews to live a Jewish life, to be free from persecution. That's fine. But that's not the Torah ideal. The Torah ideal is something higher, that we should be an Am Kadosh, a holy nation, to be servants of God. Avadayim. God took us out of Egypt, where we were slaves, to be slaves to God. Servants to God is a better way of putting it. That's our freedom. So I suggest, and this is what I do, I do not say, Liot Am Chafshi. I substitute that as loudly as I can, Liot Am Kadosh, Biartzenu, to be a holy nation in our land.